Hi, Roy.
Hey, Katie. How are you doing?
Maybe to make this easier on us, we should just begin by explaining right here in front of everybody that what we're doing is a fishbowl conversation.
Right. I think that would be good. Otherwise, it looks pretty strange.
That we're not looking at them.
Exactly.
That we're looking at each other, mm-hmm. but we're not. What's a fishbowl? A fishbowl is where a group of people gather and have conversation with another group maybe surrounding them or outside of it, like where you can see in and observe. And as I like to call it, compassionate observers. I had a professor in seminary, Jane Vernard. She taught group spiritual direction. And there was a whole circle that was outside of the spiritual direction people that their job was to be the compassionate observers.
Mm-hmm. Well, that makes sense that our congregation could be these listeners, these active listeners, mm-hmm. as they hear us talk.
Feels weird, though, doesn't it?
It does.
Okay.
A little bit.
Don't look at them.
Oh. Okay.
So the other thing that we're doing as far as doing beloved conversations, calling this our fishbowl conversation, beloved conversations, is that we're modeling conversation across divisions.
Right. Just like Regina's story, you know, we differ in our skin color, eye color, and other, our gender, all kinds of ways, but we still are one, and, you know, we're going to kind of model how we can interact and light of our differences.
Yeah, and I was thinking that because we're doing this as a fishbowl, it takes pressure off the congregation to respond.
Yeah.
We're not preaching today.
Right.
We're talking with each other. So that.
Good. Well, I would
do you
like
have a story.
I have a story. In fact, it's more like a bird's eye view of the fishbowl.
Love it.
You know, it kind of takes us beyond the immediate to kind of the ideal as we begin our conversation. So this is a story that involves a friend of mine, Wilson Camelli Nyoma, mm-hmm. who's at the time that I knew him was a Stanford undergraduate student who's from Kenya. He's Maasai, a tribe that does a lot of herding of cattle, and cows are extremely important to the Maasai, both spiritually, economically, and in terms of identity. So in this story, Camelli, my friend Camelli, was in the United States at the time of 9/11 and was extremely distraught. And everyone around the world, you know, as you recall, was very upset over the loss of 3,000 people
in New York City.
What's going on here? And how do you respond, you know? And how, Camelli wants to know, how does his people respond? How can they respond to this, the agony, you know, happening in America? So he went back to Kenya and spoke with tribal elders, and all of a sudden, in this kind of brilliant flash, figured out that one way of responding would be offering aid to America. Mm. You know, just like we do through UUSC, the Service Committee.
You're a board member.
I'm a board member of that, so I know very well how we can offer both material and programmatic aid in Haiti, you know, during, you know, after their disaster. Mm-hmm. Likewise, Camelli and his tribal elders said, hey, let's do something for Americans who are suffering from a terrible tragedy.
Can you show one of the pictures?
Yeah, I think that would be
great. Didn't you say, you had told me when you said we were going to share this story that he looked...
This is Camelli. Yeah, it looks just like him. So the artist did a wonderful rendition of my friend. And here he is with some Maasai kids, brethren, returning from college in America. And basically, when he talked to the tribal elders, let me show you that. Here, they decided they were going to give America 14 cows as aid, right?
Mm.
Very different framework, very different way of thinking.
Why did they pick 14?
That I'm not sure. It might be sacred that's what they did. Maybe 7 times 2 or something, you know, mysterious. Actually, as an aside, Camelli told me that their idea of God is very similar to the Jewish idea of God, this kind of solar deity or monotheistic notion, except that they realize their expression of spirituality in the form of sharing and possessing and taking care of their cattle. So he met with the elders, and the elders met with an emissary from the United States, if I could find that picture. Right here, there's the American in his hat, and then all of the tribal members. And basically, the Maasai offered, this is a true story, offered these 14 cows to the Bush White House, which politely refused because they didn't have enough, I guess, grass to graze in the White House lawn, but it was a thought that counts. Mm-hmm. And beyond this kind of little story, I think this is a beautiful ideal version of Beloved Conversations, because we have two radically different cultures, radically different ways of expressing care, concern, empathy, and an event that was unsettling and shook everyone up. And the Maasai came up with their own unique perspective and way of giving and offering aid to America. So I love the story, and I just wanted to share that with you.
I think that's a great way to help us understand what are we talking about when we use the term Beloved Conversations. We said that we wanted to name what that was in a number of ways. You named that just by telling that story in kind of a meta way, and maybe another, and we're modeling it right now, having conversation. And Beloved Conversations are transformative, learning, and spirituality.
Right. Yeah, if I could kind of say a little bit about the background to Beloved Conversations. Basically, the educational framework started out maybe 20 years ago in something called transformative learning. So I love this idea, you know how kids, when they're born up to adulthood, are formed. We call it formative learning. You know, we give them structures, we give them values, all kinds of things externally, which they receive and, you know, incorporate in their lives and their personalities. Well, a lot of educators decided, you know, what do we do after someone's 18? I mean, how does learning proceed, you know, beyond childhood? And they came up with the idea that if early education is formative, adult education is transformative.
Transformative.
Yeah, you get rid of those old structures. You try something new, you know, you put on different hats. You change the perspective. And they figure we live in a democracy, and that democratic learning in small groups that's transformative would be the ideal way for us to, you know, spiritually advance. And, you know, I just love that kind of idea.
Yeah, I think it's great. So I guess the question that comes up for me is then that the story that you told, and we're in these groups with different cultures, does that mean that people of color then are responsible for being my teacher? In other words, the people from Kenya or anybody who comes to our Beloved Conversations, does that mean that you have to be my teacher?
No, not at all. That's the beauty of transformative learning, is that we each are attempting to grow, to develop new frames of reference. You know, I, in the context of my being, you know, African American, yours in the context of being European American, we're shedding the old, we're putting on new hats, we're learning about each other's perspective in a very different way from, you know, conventional cultural sensitivity training or diversity training.
Mark Hicks, who is the creator of this, of the particular curriculum that we've been using here at Star King Church. You might have, I'm sure folks have heard us talking about Beloved Conversations. And in the fall, they were invited to come to this retreat that we had for, it was on November 8th and 9th, I think, where a number of congregations, four of them, came together to go on to a retreat, Friday night, Saturday retreat. Mm-hmm. And then after each of the folks who had joined in on that retreat came back to their individual congregations and continued meeting together in small groups, mm-hmm. like small group ministry that we have here, yeah. or covenant groups, we sometimes call mm-hmm. them. And this our covenant group, the folks who had joined in, mm-hmm. which tended to be, I think, folks who had been part of the Anti-Racist Multicultural Alliance were the ones who were who went to the Beloved Conversations retreat. But that Beloved Conversations, this curriculum, aims to be a tool to get beyond a monocultural expression so that Unitarian Universalism can speak mm-hmm. as it does, boldly, justly, and compassionately, to bring about the world that we want to create that is already here with us.
Yeah, that's great, because I think Beloved Conversations, you know, is very compatible with, you know, UU values. I'd like to read a quote from Paul Raiser, who's a noted UU theologian.
Yes.
And Paul says, "We need to become a genuinely multiracial and multicultural faith, theologically and demographically. We need to do this not because it's the politically correct thing to do, or because our congregations need yet another exercise in anti-racism and cultural sensitivity training, though they might, or because we think it will attract new members, though it may. Instead, we need to make this collective journey for spiritual and theological reasons. Becoming a multiracial, multicultural, Unitarian Universalism fulfills the vision we have long held. As the Reverend Dr. Mark Morrison Reed has put it, we are moved to do this because we see the richness in human diversity and are excited by its possibility. Given the cultural context in which we now find ourselves, this is where we are drawn by our deepest theological principles and religious values. Religious liberalism has always been marked by its ability to engage and respond to the circumstances of its time and place. This is what has kept our theology intellectually credible and socially relevant."
I like that he puts it so positively.
Yeah.
Like that we aren't there yet, but I don't feel like a failure. I feel hopeful hearing him talk about it. Mm-hmm. And also, I want to just say that about Paul Raiser, that mm-hmm. that was part of his Berry Street lecture.
Oh, okay.
In 2009, I believe, mm-hmm. that those words were taken from that. The Berry Street lecture is the very historic lecture that has been given since Unitarianism began, and is given every year right at the beginning of General Assembly. So that's where that came from, inspiring us to do that work.
Great. And I see it Paul's ideas and Mark Hicks's Beloved Conversation, you know, it's really different from what I'm used to, you know, in terms of cultural sensitivity training and diversity training. I mean, in my experience, someone of color like myself gets up, you know, in a well-honed story, you know, about past injustices and hurts, recites it. The rest of the people who, you know, are usually European Americans, you know, either feel bad or guilty or fed up or mm-hmm. tired or something.
Yeah.
And we all leave without changing ourselves. Mm-hmm. You know, I have my story. They have their
response. I have no story.
And you have no story, right? You have no story, you know, and, you know, yeah. it doesn't really progress,
right.
you know, and it doesn't transform in the way.
Or my story becomes only a reflection of about people of color, my
That's
relationship,
right.
rather than just my story,
right.
whatever my story
right.
is.
Right, yeah. You don't have a story in right. kind of conventional training.
I Darcy Baxter, because we've been talking about this, had just shared with us this talk she gave with this the group that she's doing reproductive justice work at the University of California at Berkeley. Mm-hmm. And she shared with them comments that the stories we tell are complex and that many times the system tries to erase any individual stories we might have. So she said, can we learn to tell just our piece of the story?
Yeah.
Like she told the story about her family growing up in upstate New York and her family's dedication to justice work, but that's her
history.
That was
Darcy's story. One of the interesting things that happened after that first night in Walnut Creek for me, you know, was not so much by telling a story that day, but I went home and started dreaming about a lot of angry dreams. Anger at, you know, as I've mentioned, past hurts. Anger at myself for not, you know, calling out the injustice. For, you know, fear of keeping my job or promotions or other personal reasons. And all that kind of percolated inside me and caused these little weird nightmares, and I brought it back to the group.
So it seems funny. So you had done anti-racist work in the past.
Tons of anti-racist work.
So we do a Friday night,
and
all of a sudden you go home just after one evening, and you start dreaming.
Yeah, I have nightmares about it.
Nightmares.
But healthy nightmares. I mean, I think...
So what happened?
So what happened was...
On Saturday
when I came back, and I told the story because it's in a safe and trusting group to everyone in Beloved Conversations. And I felt held, listened to, and felt like I reached a different level in my own ambition for spiritual growth around issues of anti-racism, you know, that I could safely tell a story. It wasn't a protected story like diversity training, but it was showing my vulnerability and the complexity of racism.
Well, as we were preparing to do this, I remember once again feeling like, oh, I can't even remember what happened to me. Like, I'm so good at doing that erasing stuff that, and you had to remind me that I talked about where I had been, I'll say, as a white liberal.
Yeah.
And kind of moving into a different place of really being an ally, and what happened to me as I made a shift, over a period of years ago, making the shift. I have to see what I wrote down on this piece of paper that I don't have anymore. There it is. I know what it was. That what changed in me was that it wasn't just an attitude, it encompassed action, things that I do now in my daily life, my commitment, my ongoing commitment, not like I've taken some class or something, but that I'm always committed to doing this kind of beloved conversation, to staying in the conversation, to having an ongoing, what I call spiritual practice. And the reason I call it that is because it isn't something that's started and completed. Mm-hmm. It's a commitment that I've made, a shift I've made in my life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great cue for the idea that being a white liberal, or the term white liberal, is just a descriptor. It's like a personality, being introverted, extroverted, or a series of values you hold. It's a state. Mm-hmm. Whereas being an ally, you know, as we progress through Beloved Conversations, is a practice. It's an action that's ongoing every day. When you're an ally, you're reflecting, you know, deeply about what's going on in the moment-to-moment interactions with other people, with people, you know, people of color or people who are European in ancestry. It's sort of a fascinating thing that it's dynamic and reflective, as opposed to just saying, I'm a white liberal, you know,
which
tells you how you vote.
I wanted to share, tells me how I vote.
Tells how you vote, how basically. Vote. It's a proxy for voting.
Although it probably doesn't make it as easy to vote as if I'm doing it actively.
That's true.
All the time. Yep. So I wanted to share something that Mark Hicks wrote from the curriculum, especially because on my Facebook feed this past week, I don't know if you've seen this, but we are right now in Boston. Everything's in boxes. They had their last worship service at 25 Beacon Street, and everything is being moved out of our old building that we have held all these years, so I'm just going to read this quote.
Okay, great.
Since our beginnings, this is Mark Hicks talking, since our beginnings as elites in Boston, Unitarian Universalism came of age rooted in a very particular racial, ethnic culture as insiders to and shapers of American culture. We received many benefits. For example, when our headquarters moved from one location to another on Beacon Street, we petitioned to the Massachusetts legislature to keep our address because even though we were moving to a new building, in other words, 25 Beacon Street is really out of geographical, logical order in terms of where it's located on Beacon Street.
I saw the wrong side of the assembly.
So Mark says, now that's power.
Yeah.
In similar ways, the values, customs, and traditions of that culture, for example, the role of gender, age, wealth, kinship, were integrated and normalized into the way we thought about theology, the way we worship, who could preach and teach on our behalf, and so forth. It was clear that the cultural assumptions connected with race were threatening to some of our white ancestors, arguing that it was an impertinence to spread Unitarianism among people of color, and that's actually a historical reference. As we work toward building a congregational culture that is truly welcoming to cultural groups other than our tradition nestled in its single white Bostonian culture, we must consider the lingering thoughts, feelings, and behaviors that are hidden in the DNA of our congregational culture.
Beautifully said. You know, it kind of occurs to me that maybe it's the elephant in the room around anti-racism is that, you know, both of us are going to be leaving here in a couple of months. And, you know, I think some may have concern about whether this will continue.
Yeah.
My thoughts are that we have a critical mass of people who are devoted to beloved conversations and anti-racism work. So I'm extraordinarily hopeful and optimistic that, you know, it will continue long after we are gone.
In other words, this is our way because we're not preaching. We're just talking to each other.
So they know.
We would really like to see.
Exactly, yeah.
It's just what we would like.
Different form of persuasion.
Because I was... Yeah, it is. Yeah. So I'm thinking of those things that you said, and that maybe, like right now we have a group of people that are doing this, but that I would like to see this work moving from an associated group to just becoming part of the fabric of the church, actually being woven into the fabric of the church in all of the ways we do shared ministry and all the ways we do church, in all of our ways.
Okay.
You were going to share from Alice Walker.
Yes.
You know how I know that?
How you read my mind. Or saw my card or something. So I just wanted to share this apt quote from the opening words from Alice Walker, where she says that truth comes out when all sides of a story are put together. I just love that. You know, I just see that as, you know, integrating all the feelings, the spiritual inklings, and even narratives of hurt, you know, into one giant fabric of a story. And that, I think, is the beauty of Beloved Conversations and the process of creating this quilt of, you know, anti-racism.
Wonderful. So let's close with the chrysalis, the poem from Mark Hicks.
Yes. I find myself in the time between selves. I am pregnant with myself. Do you realize what this means?
It means that every part of me must die. All my cells and organs open and dissolve, for I need their juicy substances to nurture my new blood.
Let teeth become eyes, gullet become brain, gray become bright red, and hair turn into wings.
This is the truth of me. I was, am, and shall be myself, forever new.
forever changed by changing, creature blessed by consciousness, alive.
And this is not a voiceless act, but a process resounding inside death with lusty shouts and whoops.
A regular and visible below the carcass veil.
And death grows thinner, giving way to God knows what.
Diminishing like gauze of sponge sugar melting in the sun.
Soon I will be full ripe with myself.
Able to nurse on sweet nectar, free and light as living rain.
Soon I will fly.